California, the Golden State. Its very name suggests a place of extraordinary beauty and opportunity. But even before surfing or Silicon Valley or the movies were ever dreamed of, long before Al Jolson recorded California, Here I Come, people flocked to California for a better life.
California, here I come, right back where I started from, where flowers, of flowers bloom in the sun. Each morning at dawning, birdies sing and everything a sun. Miss said, don't be late, that's why I can hardly wait. Open up your golden gate, California, here I come.
I'm Elizabeth Yates McNamee. When my great-great-grandparents arrived in San Francisco in 1849, they found a rough, chaotic town full of shacks and tents and a lot of musical entertainment. Nearly every saloon had live music, and soon San Francisco had its own opera house. By 1890, when my grandmother was a child, the gold and silver booms were over, and Californians were struggling with some of the same issues we face now, like a boom and bust economy, immigration and unemployment. But they also had a rich and varied musical life. In the next hour, we'll take a look at that musical life. We'll hear from musicians and scholars about what was popular from 1890 to around 1910. And we'll hear what people of those times loved to listen to, before jazz or the blues, like brass band music. Some of our recordings are from that time, and they're a little scratchy, but you'll still be able to hear the music as it was performed then. But first, let's go back, even before the 1880s, way back to the gold rush. Dr. Kevin Starr is California's state librarian and author of a half dozen books on California. He describes the entertainment-mad 49ers.
Here you have a society which, through the gold rush, the 1850s, the 1860s, was propelling literally hundreds of thousands, mostly male, although increasingly after 1855, women were 10% of the population, into a new environment. And so entertainment in the mining camps, entertainment in San Francisco, took on an aura not just of distraction, but a re-evocation of civilization, of the world left behind. I think the frontier intensifies the desire for civilization. It challenges it and intensifies it.
The completion of the Transcontinental Railroad in 1869 was supposed to bring untold prosperity to this frontier California. But in 1876, disaster struck. The great Comstock silver boom collapsed, and then the banks. Hard times followed, but eventually California's economy recovered. Kevin Starr talks about one of California's great transitions.
If we take the great California-born philosopher Josiah Royce's formula of higher provincialism, we would see that you had great hopes for the higher provincialism after the railroad was complete in October 1869. But of course, you had the collapse of the financial markets in 1873. You had a decade the California novelist and historian Gertrude Atherton called the Terrible 70s. Now, in the 1880s, there's a transition. The railroad, the Atchison-Topeka-Santa Fe, comes into Southern California in the mid-1880s, and you have the migration into California during this period of wealthy people coming, especially into Southern California, health seekers, families that are looking for a good place to winter in Southern California. So I would say that the high provincialism that was expected in the 1870s was delayed by 10 to 15 years, begins to reemerge in the late 1880s, 1890s.
How is California's higher provincial identity expressed in its musical entertainment? Well, in 1880, only two theaters in downtown San Francisco offered regular entertainment, the Bush Street and the Baldwin. But by 1890, there were more theater seats in San Francisco per capita than in any other American city. In 1889, the San Francisco Chronicle stated simply, "This is a city of theatergoers." Those downtown San Francisco theaters are all gone now, but there's still one theater from that age. This is the Bayview Opera House in San Francisco, the only large public theater from the 1880s still standing. Masonic Lodge No. 313 built this theater in 1888, and it served both the Masons and the community as a multi-purpose space. This is a local youth theater production, but in 1890, the Bayview offered a huge variety of entertainments, including the most popular form of musical entertainment in America for much of the 19th century, the minstrel show.
Get in, says Big Black Joe. Old Joe, old Joe, kicking up behind, and the call for the young gal kicking up behind. Old Joe, old Joe, kicking up behind, and the call for the young gal kicking up behind. Old Joe, I'll come Dinah Joe, what you doing there? Wanna get a gun to go shoot a bear? Says she, old Joe, that game won't do. Joe got so mad he busts his shoe. Old Joe, kicking up behind, and the call for the young gal kicking up behind. Old Joe.
The minstrel show was a kind of variety entertainment that sprang up in the late 1830s. The performers were white men with blackened faces, and they put together programs of jokes and novelty acts, dances, and songs like this.
Then old Joe starts straight off home. He walked all the way by the light of the moon. His old wife laughs his chilling grin to see old Joe come back again.
Hard as it is to believe now, minstrelsy was the most popular musical entertainment in America for over half a century, from the 1840s until the 1880s. According to Mark Twain, who wrote about minstrel shows in his autobiography,
"The minstrel show was as common in America as the 4th of July. I remember the first Negro musical show I ever saw. It must have been in the early 40s. It was a new institution. In our village of Hannibal, we had not heard of it before, and it burst upon us as a glad and stunning surprise. The minstrel show was born in the early 40s. It had a prosperous career for about 35 years. Then it degenerated into a variety show, and it was nearly all variety show with a Negro act or two thrown in incidentally. To my mind, it was a thoroughly delightful thing and a most competent laughter compeller, and I am sorry it is gone."
The idea of minstrelsy now, of course, is appalling. We don't find ethnic stereotyping amusing, so it's hard for us now to get beyond that part of minstrelsy, to understand what was so appealing. Was it the only way white Americans could express admiration of African-American culture? Was it a nostalgia for better times that had never been? Whatever the reason, there was almost no place in America where minstrel shows were more popular than California. Minstrel troupes played everywhere, from San Francisco's Tony theaters to logging camps, well into the 1890s.
"I come to town the other night. I heard the noise and I saw the fight. The watchman was a-running around, crying, 'Old Dan Tucker's come to town. Get out of the way. Get out of the way. Get out of the way, old Dan Tucker. Your team's come to suffer.'"
Dale Cockrell's book, Demons of Disorder, explores minstrelsy's wide appeal. Cockrell is professor of Southern culture at Vanderbilt University.
In 1855, minstrelsy was a form that welcomed any and all. And by 1855, anybody across the board, from presidents to Mark Twain, to common class, to African Americans, would show up in minstrel theaters, and did. One of the characteristics of some minstrel songs is a energetic application of rhythm. You do find in Old Dan Tucker's dun dun dee dun da dun da dun dee dun dun dee dun da dun dee dun dun dee dun dun dun. You can feel the syncopation in that. And that's a song from 1843, right at the beginning of the Virginia Minstrels.
Get out of the way, get out of the way, Old Dan Tucker, you're too late, come to supper.
Stephen Foster in Oh Susanna, Oh Don't You Cry For Me, has got a similar kind of energetic use of rhythm. You find it in Turkey in the Straw, which is a tune that was used in the minstrel shows. That's a tune that's associated with the Tenderloin District in Natchez, Mississippi in the 18-teens and the 1820s. It's music for sweating and getting excited and energetic and happy. It doesn't have so much to do with race as it has to do with a group of people. That is the inheritance, I think, from the minstrel show. That's the kind of music, it's that excitement about moving your bodies to rhythms that minstrelsy projected onto the stage that has been passed into the present.
But minstrel songs weren't the only popular music. Stephen Bauer is a rock drummer and musicologist who teaches at Occidental College. He's written about American social politics and music in the 19th century, and about how moral improvement and nostalgia became themes in American music. Bauer gives us an idea of how American musical life began to change towards the year 1900.
Several factors had a widespread influence on every aspect of American life in the late 19th century. The rise of industry, the rise of cities, and immigration. All these people started settling in new cities, so we see a huge rise in the urban population. The rise of the city brought into greater view things like crime, poverty, prostitution, vice, and many leaders in 19th century America perceived a severe moral crisis. And they believed that religion, which had previously been kind of the basis for maintaining the moral order, could no longer serve that purpose. There's a firm belief in the power of culture to influence people for the better. There's a quote that pops up in numerous music journals throughout the century, and that quote comes from a 17th century Scottish nationalist named Fletcher of Saltoun. Let me make the ballads of a nation, and I care not who makes the laws.
Old men spare the tree, touch not a single bough. In youth it sheltered me, and I'll protect it now.
There's a number of trends in popular song in the 19th century. One of them is the sentimental song. We get songs like Woodman Spare the Tree, which gives us this imagery of a man talking about his childhood and spending hours under the tree, but now the tree's being knocked down for the sake of building something. So this idea that longing for the past, when life was simpler, more rustic, and the old rural America is disappearing in the face of rapid urbanization.
People did long for the past, But rapid urbanization with its drudgery and pollution brought one consolation. Growing towns and cities all had theaters, and the railroads brought an amazing variety of musical performers all the way to California. Catherine Preston, leading expert on opera in America, shows us how important theaters were in those times.
Throughout the entire 19th century, Americans treated theater very differently than we treat theater today. Today, theater is expensive. It's a special deal. You buy your tickets way in advance. It's a night out. In the 19th century, people went to the theater on a whim. They did this. It's almost like turning the television on today. Most modern Americans don't realize this, but remaining into the 1880s and 1890s, the vast majority of theatrical entertainment is musical theater, if for no other reason than every theater had an orchestra. One week you'd have vaudeville, the next week you'd have minstrelsy, the week after that maybe something else, melodrama or something. So even in the stratified theaters in the late 19th century, you have this incredible variety of musical theater that was, I guess, akin to the multiplex today. In the later part of the 19th century, you have more of an influx of operetta, which is a new form introduced to this country in the late 1870s, but certainly the most important and most popular operetta were Gilbert and Sullivan's operas, which came here in the late 1870s.
When you sail the ocean blue and the salt sea ships of beauty, when you saw the men and crew and attentive to our duty, and the boats were so free on the bank of the sea, we sat to our guns all day.
Gilbert and Sullivan's HMS Pinafore opened in San Francisco in 1878 and remained a local favorite for decades. But it wasn't just light opera or operetta that Californians loved. Catherine Preston wrote the book Opera on the Road, and it shows how opera was truly popular music. Arias like this one from Bellini's La Sonnambula were performed over and over until everyone knew them by heart.
Opera today is an art form that is considered elitist and very expensive and aristocratic to a certain extent. In the 19th century, especially before the Civil War, it was very much a part of popular theater. You have the same opera being consumed by people of various classes, not just the upper classes. So you may have Sonnambula, people whistling the tunes of Sonnambula, but it's being consumed, if you want to use that term, by people of a variety of classes, not just the upper classes, not just the middle classes, not just the working classes. And I think that's really important.
Just how popular was opera? Were people really whistling the tunes? Well, here's proof. An 1894 wax cylinder recording of the Anvil Chorus from Verdi's immensely popular opera, Il Trovatore. Opera, minstrel shows, and those novelty acts, California theaters booked them all. But as the 19th century began to wane, economic and social changes were also felt in the musical world. As Stephen Bauer observes, the rise of industry, including the music industry, began to influence taste.
One of the biggest trends in American musical culture after the Civil War is the bifurcation into high and low culture, or classical art music on the one hand and popular music on the other. Earlier in the 19th century, there wasn't this bifurcation. You would go to a night out at the theater and you would hear Beethoven and minstrel songs, mixed in on the same stage. Interestingly, there's really a battle over the middle classes during this moment. And the cultural leadership, those who are promoting opera houses and urging the wealthy to donate to fund symphonies and what have you, are of the opinion that this is good for everybody. We have to expose the masses to this high culture, and it will edify and educate the masses. Particularly popular were Felix Mendelssohn's oratorios. And in this particular genre, you will see it's also a didactic genre. You come out of the oratorio having learned a lesson. And one of the most popular works in all of America during the late 19th century was the oratorio Elijah by Mendelssohn.
There were lots of performances of Mendelssohn's Elijah, but no recordings, of course. In those pre-recording days, people would buy the sheet music, even if they had to order it from New York or Europe, and they'd play it on their pianos at home. And by the 1890s, sheet music was big business. Stephen Bauer.
One thing we see in popular music in the late 19th century is the rise of a popular music industry. The ability to distribute sheet music on a national level doesn't really come into being until late in the 19th century. The first national hit, if you will, that sold a million copies of sheet music the year it was released was Charles K. Harris's After the Ball.
After the ball is over, after the break of morn, after the dance is leaving, after the stars are gone.
Many consumers of these songs were women. This was the Progressive Era, when people, especially women, were seeking ways to improve society. California was an ideal milieu for women's leadership in social reform. Kevin Starr talks about progressivism in California.
The 80s have that quality of the emergence of women onto the American scene as cultural protagonists, as women reformers. In California, this is a very interesting issue because you don't have many women in California in the 1840s, the 1850s, even the 1860s. You look at photographs of San Francisco during this period, it looks like a world of men. By the time you get to the 90s, you start seeing women on the streets dressed beautifully, elements of refinement noted in San Francisco, society, coverage of society, of social events. Now, the 1890s sees a lot of effort in California on behalf of California women for the vote. The club, women's club movement is very intense in the 1890s, early 1900s, especially in Southern California. The kindergarten movement, Emma Marwardell's theories, etc., Kate Douglas Wiggins, the incredible presence of two very important women, Mrs. Jane Lathrop Stanford and Stanford University, and Mrs. Phoebe Apherson Hearst, who is the sort of refounder of the University of California at Berkeley.
So hasten on, ye blithesome day, when we'll be grown to women. We meet to vote ere very long, and stop the boys from drinking. When girls can vote, hurrah, hurrah, salutes will not be here. There won't be one in all the land.
Reform songs like When the Girls Can Vote were common during the Progressive Era. Another indication of the reforming influence of women in California was the increase in musical entertainment that was wholesome or uplifting, like vaudeville.
Young Herman Von Bello, a musical fellow, played on a big cello each night. Sweet melodies rare in a dance garden where dancers danced round and round with delight. One night he saw dancing a maid so entrancing, his heart caught on fire inside. And music so mellow he sawed on his cello, she waltzed up to him and she cried. Yippee-yay-yay, yippee-yay-yay, I don't care.
play me that sweet melody. Yippee-yay-yay-yay-yay. My heart wants to holler hooray. Sing of joy, sing of bliss. Home was never like this. Yippee.